Pro tip, pack only a carry-on for the Hajj. Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Almost 2 million Muslims made the trip to Mecca this year for the Hajj. One of them was New York Times reporter Dia Hadid.
I would describe myself as a total, like, Hajj rookie, because I definitely overpacked for a pilgrimage.
Also, amid the destruction in Syria, a group of volunteers called the White Helmets tries to save the wounded. A new documentary about them was made using footage gathered by the volunteers themselves.
You know, certainly we've had to question ourselves about if there was a war like what's happened in Syria in New York or in London or where we are today in Toronto, whether or not we would do the same as these very brave individuals.
Those stories and more today here on The World. Thanks for being here. It's Thursday, but in Saudi Arabia, it's not just any Thursday. It's the last day of the Hajj, that important pilgrimage to the Saudi city of Mecca. The Hajj is one of the five central pillars of the Islamic faith, and all Muslims are encouraged to do the pilgrimage at least once in their lives. Even for one skeptic, the spirituality of the journey is undeniable.
What has immediately struck me is after the Hajj, I want to be a better person. Being mindful and being grateful and stepping outside of one's own self, I think, to feel the energy of everything around us.
One woman's experience on the Hajj, that's later on The World, but let's begin today in Syria. The ceasefire brokered by the U.S. and Russia seems to be holding in parts of the country. It's better news than we've heard in a while, but there are plenty of reasons to be concerned about the ceasefire succeeding in the long run. The World's Matthew Bell has the latest.
First, the good news. Things have been relatively quiet in Syria, even in parts of Aleppo that have been through so much fighting in recent months. This Free Syrian Army fighter told Reuters that the truce was holding in Aleppo. People were leaving their shelters to go shopping, walk around, and even the kids came out to play. It's like we're reliving our childhood, he said, and getting a taste of our beautiful world. But this is still Syria, so there's bad news as well. United Nations officials said they have trucks loaded up with humanitarian supplies ready to go into besieged areas, but neither the Syrian government nor rebel groups have done their part to guarantee safe passage for the aid convoys.
So one way of saying it is that grown, well-fed men still prevent us from coming to the real relief of civilians, women, children, wounded, in besieged and other areas.
Jan Egeland is the coordinator of the UN Humanitarian Task Force in Syria. He told the BBC today that things are getting even more desperate in places like Madaya, near Syria's border with Lebanon. People there are on the verge of starvation, and they're facing a meningitis epidemic. Rebel-held parts of Aleppo are also in need of food and supplies. Egeland says the armed factions on the ground need to stop wasting time.
What we had hoped was that the Russians and the Americans by now would have told the government and armed opposition groups that this is the way it should be and that we would have been had the access that we needed by now.
This was all part of the ceasefire agreement. First, put a stop to the fighting. Next, open up humanitarian aid corridors, and then start working toward a negotiated solution. The worry now is that the whole process will stall. Hostilities could resume at any time, and that would put a quick end to hopes for a longer-term truce in Syria. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The ceasefire has also provided a break for Syria's first responders. In rebel-held areas, they're known as the White Helmets. They're teams of volunteers who rush in to search for survivors after airstrikes destroy buildings and neighborhoods. Civilians in those areas have nobody else to turn to.
It's not like they can pick up a phone when a bomb goes and an ambulance comes or a fire engine comes.
That's Joanna Notasagara. She's the producer of a new Netflix documentary called The White Helmets. Orlando von Einsiedel directed the film. He joined me as well. Because it's so dangerous to work inside Syria, the filmmakers conducted their interviews across the Syrian border in Turkey during White Helmet training sessions. But the most dramatic footage in the documentary, von Einsiedel says, are the scenes the first responders filmed themselves in Aleppo with a broadcast-quality camera the filmmakers loaned them.
They film all of their rescue work, and we collaborated with them on this. We shot in Turkey, and they shared the footage that they'd been gathering inside Syria.
So you gave them the cameras. They shot these scenes, some of them really kind of nail-biting, wrenching scenes during attacks. Is that correct?
They were already using GoPros and smaller cameras, things like 5Ds, to really gather evidence and to make sure that the incidents that they were responding to are recorded. So there are, you can imagine, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of hours of this footage.
It's really daunting what these first responders, these white helmets, have to do to reach bomb blast victims. I mean, great danger. They use listening devices to hear under the rubble. They have to use these massive saws to cut through huge slabs of concrete. How much had you actually considered before making the doc just what a slog this job is?
We thought we had an idea of what these men and women went through. I mean, inside Syria, they're responding to scores of airstrikes every single day. When we were with them in Turkey, what really struck us is after the training every day, when they got back online and got some internet, immediately their phones would start to ring and the reports from what happened that day would start to come through. And, you know, they'd be getting news of 200 bombs hitting one particular city in a day. For us, it was very emotional to go through that with them, but clearly they were going through an enormous amount more.
There is a deeply emotional moment in the film, the scene when the White Helmets recount their rescue of a tiny baby in Aleppo. And the footage of that child, its dust-covered head cradled by a White Helmet who reaches deep below the concrete to pull the infant out. I'd like us to hear just a bit of that. So, Joanna and Orlando, what struck you about that story and just what the White Helmets live every day?
That baby happened to be less than a month old when he was pulled out. It was a three-story building. How he really survived is anyone's guess. But they talk about that story often because it really represents the hope that they have throughout the organization that each life that they save can go on to mean something. I mean, their motto is actually to save one life is to save all of humanity. We happen to be lucky enough to meet baby Mahmoud 2 years later, and to watch them watch him kind of running around as now a young child was really quite profound.
And the volunteer who saved the baby was himself killed recently, right?
That was a real blow to the organization, Khaled Hulla. After he saved that baby, a lot of media organizations got interest and he became quite a spokesperson for the White Helmets, and he was also one of their earliest volunteers. So losing him was particularly tragic.
Early on in the film, one of the subjects tells us about their work of the White Helmets. Any human being, he says, no matter who they are or which side they're on, if they need our help, it's our duty to save them. The charter of the White Helmets talks about neutrality, but the force works exclusively in opposition areas, and that's something you don't really address in the film.
Well, I think they'd like to operate in regime areas. The regime does not let them operate there, and in fact, the regime actively targets them. For us, as filmmakers, we wanted to try and tell a non-political story. We wanted to tell a human story. And Syria is so hard for people around the world to engage with. It's so tragic. We've had 5 years of this horrendous conflict. But the White Helmets are an inspirational story, and we really hope it's a story that resonates with people.
On YouTube, you can find videos of what appeared to be a White Helmet celebrating with fighters carrying the flag of an Al-Qaeda-linked rebel group, fighters who are not what the U.S. State Department would call moderates. What do you make of that?
We did a lot of research into the White Helmets. Of course, in any war, there's a lot of rumour, there's a lot of incidents that go around. We are very comfortable that the White Helmets deal with their disciplinary processes correctly, and we are really sure that their work is overwhelmingly humanitarian.
By not going into Syria yourselves, though, are you rock solid that you feel you got the whole story?
Yes, I think we are. We looked into this considerably before doing it. We spent a lot of time with the White Helmets. We stand by our work.
So Raed Saleh, the head of the White Helmets, was supposed to collect a major humanitarian award in Washington last April, but his visa was revoked and he was denied entry. What was that all about, do you know?
You would have to ask State Department about that. Raed has certainly been welcomed all over the world, including at the UN several times. I think it's clear that he speaks from a humanitarian point of view, and certainly many influential governments and entities are very welcoming to him.
So that idea of getting the public to be interested in what's going on in Syria, as filmmakers, what's the trick? Because it feels like a lot of eyes have kind of strayed away from Syria over the past 5 years of this terrible war.
These guys are just normal people. They're ordinary civilians just like me or you. you know, certainly we've had to question ourselves about if there was a war like what's happened in Syria in New York or in London or where we are today in Toronto, whether or not we would do the same as these very brave individuals.
Did meeting them change any thoughts on that for you? Would you do it?
That's a really good question. I'd love to believe that I would, but at the same time, I also recognise just how extraordinary these guys are, that they can continue to live under daily bombardment and yet still get up every single day and risk their own lives to save complete strangers. I'd love to think I'd do it. I just don't know.
The documentary is called The White Helmets. Netflix will be releasing it tomorrow. Orlando von Einsiedel is a director and Joanna Natasigara is a producer. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I saw The White Helmets. The rescuers are heroic. The two-minute trailer will give you a brief but gripping sense of what they do. We've got that trailer over at PRI.org. As a reporter, you can find yourself sometimes in really strange places.
I'm in the village of Fatmai in Azerbaijan, and my left foot is in Asia, and my right foot is in Europe.
That's Joshua Kuchera. He's currently traveling the length of the border between Europe and Asia, from the Bosphorus in Turkey all the way up to the Russian Arctic. He paused in Azerbaijan to send us some reflections on his trip so far.
It doesn't really feel like I'm on a continental boundary here. I'm standing in what's basically a dump of discarded construction materials on the side of a somewhat busy road. But there's also, next to me here, a border marker that the Azerbaijan Geographical Society put up 3 years ago, marking what they say is now the border between Europe and Asia. There's no consensus on where exactly the border between Europe and Asia goes. It's fairly universally accepted that the border goes from the Black Sea to the Caspian Sea, but most of the variations cross north of here and place Azerbaijan entirely in Asia. But this doesn't fit very well with Azerbaijan's sense of itself. They like to think of themselves as at least partly European. For example, they held the Eurovision Song Contest here in 2012. And so this new border that the Azerbaijanis have created would change that and place about 1/16th of their country inside Europe. Most geographers will tell you that it makes much more sense to think about one continent, Eurasia, rather than trying to divide it into two parts, not least because it forces you to think of some pretty featureless places like the one I'm standing in as representing a continental divide. But geographers occasionally have made efforts to try to redefine the border, and it's usually been connected in one way or another with politics. It was under Peter the Great, for example, that Russian geographers fixed the eastern border of Europe at the Ural Mountains, and this was closely connected to his efforts to try to make Russia into a European country. Later in the Soviet Union, in the 1950s and 60s, geographers tried to again redefine the border. That effort also was politicized because then Russians didn't believe that Muslims were Europeans, and so they drew the border between Europe and Asia well north of Azerbaijan.
East is east and west is west, and never the twain shall meet. Not. The debate continues. That was Joshua Kuchera on the border, maybe, between Europe and Asia. His story comes to us courtesy of the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Just ahead, beware the polar bears. You're with the world. Victims of domestic violence are often given this piece of advice: get away from the person attacking you. If you're living with them, move out. But there are a whole bunch of reasons why it's not easy to just leave someone, especially if you're paying rent together. But a new law has just taken effect in Ontario in Canada to address that. The law allows people who are being abused to get out of their situation without losing their rental deposit or breaking a lease. Neka McGregor is a survivor of domestic violence. She's also the founder and director of the Women's Center for Social Justice, also known as Women at the Center, which is based in Toronto. So how does this new law work, Neka?
The law is very straightforward in the sense that it focuses on people who've experienced intimate partner violence or are experiencing intimate partner violence, or a child of somebody in that situation. This new law allows them to provide notice and leave within, in Ontario, it's 28 days, as opposed to the usual 60 days that one usually has to give.
How does a tenant prove that she or he is covered by this law?
There's something called the N15 form, and it's a form that you fill out to say, I fear for my life. There's an individual, it could be my current partner, my former partner, a boyfriend who I'm afraid of, or my child is afraid of, because I've either been abused by that individual, or again, my child has been abused. So the tenant completes that notice, and then also completes a restraining order that they've received from either a criminal court or a family court, restraining the abuser, the partner, from having contact with them, and a statement saying that I have been abused. And that's really all the landlord needs in order to consider themselves served with notice. Having a law that says to a landlord, I feel unsafe, I am unsafe, and I have to leave. Having a law that says to the landlord, you have to abide by that, gives women a little bit more impetus and a little bit more confidence to actually make the move to get out.
And what do people say about the 28 days? Because 28 days is a lot shorter than waiting 60 days to end a lease. But if you're being beaten, 28 could seem like a long time.
Yeah, 28 days. And I understand sort of the need to balance the profit-driven world of landlord contracts that you have with the need to keep the woman safe. And so I think 28 days is the shortest in any jurisdiction in terms of the notices being given.
So the law lets victims of violence get out of their dangerous situations, but where do they go?
That is the biggest challenge for a lot of women, because if you don't have family supports, if you don't have friends, neighbors, people who are able to take you and your children in, women are oftentimes left going back to that abusive situation. But again, I don't want to minimize the importance of the legislation. It isn't everything for all situations, but it's a fantastic start. And it does address a critical, urgent need for women who are trying to leave.
As a victim of domestic violence yourself, how would this law have affected you when you were going through this?
I was one of the fortunate ones because I actually did have family support, even though all my family was out in the UK. But I had people, my dad, my sisters, who were able to send me money for me to be able to eventually buy a home. But I know for a fact that the vast majority of our members, poverty is a huge issue, and not having the sort of community supports around them, it just exacerbates women's situations. And you started off by saying, you know, why don't women leave? And it's a very common question. That is the reason why women don't leave, because they don't have access to safe, affordable housing. The idea is really, again, how do we support women? It's primarily women in this situation. How do we support women to leave a space, leave an environment that is inherently unsafe, and find alternative accommodation? So this new law is really a way for the Ontario government to help provide more supports for survivors and or their children who may be experiencing not just domestic violence, but also sexual assaults.
Neka McGregor is the founder and director of Women at the Center, a group run by survivors of abuse trying to end violence against women. She's been speaking with us from Toronto. Neka, thank you for your time.
My pleasure, and thank you so much for having me on.
Here's a scenario for you. You're part of a Russian scientific mission at a weather station on a remote Arctic island. Okay, that sounds pretty sketchy to start with. But now imagine that you've been encircled by nearly a dozen hungry polar bears. One of them is sleeping under your window. Oh yeah, and you're out of flares to scare them away. You don't have to imagine. A Russian crew in the sea north of Siberia had actually been in a standoff recently with polar bears for 2 weeks. It ended only after a nearby Russian ship was able to bring dogs and more flares to scare off the bears. I got reaction to this story from Jeff York. He's director of conservation at a group called Polar Bears International.
This is actually something that we've been expecting to increase, and in fact, we've seen increasing around the Arctic. More bears spending longer time periods on shore and getting in trouble with people.
I mean, these bears and their cubs in this recent incident, they were hungry, and 2 weeks is a long time to wait them out. It sounds like a really serious predicament. Would you agree with that?
I would. I've visited one of these remote weather stations in Russia. It's amazing. They still have people take manual measurements of things that most of us in other parts of the world use electronics for. So they have teams that are outside taking measurements 365 days a year in some incredibly remote parts of the world.
Yeah, so why are these encounters between polar bears and people happening more and more? Is it about climate change?
It absolutely is about climate change. We're seeing less and less sea ice extent. This year, we're looking at the second lowest on record. The Kara Sea, where this incident happened, there was a paper published just this week showing a loss of 17 days of what we call the sea ices, and 17 days when polar bears have sea ice available to them gone just over the last couple of decades. And so that loss of habitat is forcing bears around the Arctic to make a decision, stay on the ice over deep water or come ashore. And more are coming ashore. So they swim to shore looking for both a place to rest and to be poised as the sea ice reforms about this time of year going forward, and they can start hunting again and have access to their primary prey seals.
So what methods do you advise using when you come in contact with them? How do you avoid conflict?
For fixed stations like these weather stations, electric fencing is setting sort of your boundaries of where you allow bears to be and where you don't. Or cracker shells. Think of them as like a large firecracker, again, to push the bears away without actually making any contact. One of the best methods is something we've actually ported over from the brown and black bear world in North America and Europe, and that's using bear spray or pepper spray, having something on your person. So if you're surprised by a bear at close range, you can break off that moment and keep the bear away.
Has this happened to you?
This has happened to me. I was fortunate enough. I spent about 20 years working in the Arctic out on the sea ice handling bears with the U.S. government research team. And so I've had quite a few close encounters with bears.
I suspect you did not run out of flares, though. Otherwise, we might not be speaking with you.
Exactly. And I tell you about one in particular where we were out actually sampling, taking tissue samples from a hunter-harvested polar bear. And while we were doing that, of course, are focused on our sampling and not as much focused on our surroundings. And another polar bear came running up quite aggressively. In that case, cracker shells were used, didn't work, and we actually had to charge the bear with the snow machines and push it back.
What was your role in that rescue effort?
So that I was just one of the biologists there. My role was to jump on the back of a what they call a komatik or a sled as quickly as possible and make sure I wasn't left standing on the ice.
Wise move, Jeff York, Director of Conservation at Polar Bears International. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, 100 years ago today, the first tank was deployed in battle during World War I.
Visually, it's probably very different to what you think of as a modern tank. It was more like a, I think the term is a rhomboid, so that it's kind of coming to you as this big square thing with the cannon pod, the battle pods kind of on the side rather than on top.
The birth of the modern battle tank, coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Those rising sea levels climate scientists have been warning will cause us all kinds of misery. Well, we can stop using the future tense to talk about them. Some cities are already experiencing this, and not just because of climate change. Jakarta, for example, has long been considered one of the most flood-prone cities in the world, only partly because of climate change, and there are big plans to deal with Jakarta's water problems, but critics say those plans will hurt some of the city's poorest residents. From our partners at the Ground Truth Project here at WGBH, here's Chris Bentley.
When it comes to getting a grip on Jakarta's flooding problem, it's hard to know where to start. So let's just start here, on a seawall along the northern edge of this sprawling city. This concrete barrier defends millions of Jakartans from the Java Sea, but it's just a few inches from overtopping, and it's in bad shape.
Basically, this is a life-threatening situation.
Victor Konen works for a Dutch engineering firm that the Indonesian government has asked for help.
I mean, if this seawall breaks, you have 3 meters of water in this kampung area where nobody can swim.
That kampung is the poor neighborhood behind the wall, 100,000 people living well below sea level. That's partly because climate change is slowly pushing sea levels up. But the much bigger problem right now is that parts of Jakarta itself are sinking because the water table beneath the city is being depleted. And the city's sinking fast, nearly 10 inches a year in some places. Almost half of Jakarta is now below sea level.
So it is really a problem on top of another problem, making things even more difficult.
Jakarta's problems managing water have piled up over decades as it grew into one of the biggest cities on Earth. Now the Indonesian government is trying to address some of them with an ambitious coastal development strategy. It includes a $30 billion plan to build a new seawall, 300 miles long, and to enclose Jakarta Bay behind a chain of artificial islands. But the plan isn't sitting well with some of the very people it's supposed to protect. Kuat Wibisono is a fisherman from the kampung of Muara Anki. He says there was no consultation by the government about the plan. Wibisono says new islands in the bay are already affecting local fishermen's catch. He acknowledges that flooding can be a real problem, but he doesn't think the bay development plan will solve that, or anything else. We don't really see how the reclamation project will improve our lives, Wibisono says, because it's burying our fishing area. What he thinks it's really about is making more room for rich people. That's because the new seawall and islands would be financed by leasing the islands to developers. Engineer Victor Conan understands it sounds like a land grab.
Indeed, yeah, this does create the image that this is a project for the rich. Unfortunately, they're the only ones who can finance this kind of schemes. If you don't want to do it with this kind of high-end developments, then you have to finance with public money, and public money is scarce in Indonesia.
One place public money is being spent to try to help address Jakarta's flooding problem is inland. Jakarta is built around 13 rivers that descend from the surrounding mountains, and they're flooding more and more. Some of that's thanks to increasing rainfall, some because of the sinking land problem, some is because just about every square inch of land here has been paved over. Then there's the problem of trash and overcrowding. The banks of those rivers are filled with kampung neighborhoods, which are home to millions of people. There are shacks built on bamboo stilts right over the muddy riverbanks, and many residents toss their garbage right into the rivers.
The drainage should be very clean. It not be plugged by the rubbish.
Sri Tantri Arundhati is Indonesia's director of climate change adaptation. She says trash can clog pumps and dams and prevent the rivers from draining to the sea. So many people crowded along the riverbanks can make flooding worse.
Actually, the people, they are not legal live there because it's a government land.
So the government's answer is to relocate as many as 100,000 riverside residents to new high-rises and replace their riverside settlements with flood zones and levees. But here, too, many residents aren't happy with the government's flood control plans. This woman, named Siafichiani, was given 4 months' notice before being evicted from a kampung in East Jakarta last year. She says she stood in front of her home crying and shouting when bulldozers showed up early one morning to demolish her entire neighborhood. I can't accept the reasons they gave for the eviction, she says. It felt like my heart was torn into pieces. Safitriani's been given a low-rent apartment in one of the new high-rises. But she says she makes less money selling snacks from a cart in her new neighborhood than she did by her old house by the river. Safitriani's neighborhood tried to fight the evictions, but they lost, and many more are planned across the city. The government's hope is that unclogging the rivers and riverbanks will let floodwaters flow more freely out of the city. Jakarta's seaside poor worry that the giant seawall project could also bring more wrenching evictions, not just from the area around the new wall, but from the wall itself.
As you can see up there, people are living on the seawall.
Victor Conan, the Dutch engineer, acknowledges that any technical fixes to Jakarta's massive flooding problems only get at part of the problem.
If you strengthen the seawall, it means that these people will lose their livelihood. It's not the technical solution that's the problem. It's the social problem. How to do that so they have a future. Yeah.
Some Indonesians see Jakarta's mountain of challenges managing water as a window into the future for other cities threatened by climate change. But Conan says it's a future many cities can still avoid if they pay attention.
So the lesson for other cities is act while you still can, and then you can avoid these mega engineering solutions.
Conan says Jakarta is also a reminder that while it's possible to engineer solutions to climate change and rising water, the hard part is finding solutions that are fair. For The World, Chris Bentley, Jakarta.
Tomorrow, Chris reports on a new smartphone app that's helping the people of Jakarta respond to flood emergencies. Now, from too much water to too little, there's a water war going on in India's Silicon Valley. The states of Karnataka and Tamil Nadu are sparring over the sharing of river water. Both say they need the water for farming, and both say they're dealing with a drought. So tempers there are running high. Reporter Chavi Sachdev is our correspondent in India. And Chavi, I know this is the end of Ganesh, the big festival, so we might hear some fireworks during this interview. First, though, tell us, how bad is this water crisis?
It's been pretty bad. We've had protests before. We've had transboundary disputes before. But this is probably the first time we've had two people die from police gunfire. And we've had buses burned, kids pulled out of school, curfews, a lot of bloodshed and a lot of bitterness. And it promises not to be the last one. In fact, this very river, the Kaveri, that they're fighting about, has been a cause of problems since at least 1892, when the first arbitration happened about who gets the water and how much.
Yeah, and it seems to have reached a fever pitch now, but this kind of dispute, I mean, you've suggested this already, that has been going on for a long time. There was even a song written about it?
Yeah, way back in 2009, actually, when there was another round of protests. There's a band called Swaratma, and the lead singer was on a train one night in Karnataka on his way to Bangalore when he heard a dispute happening. There was a bunch of young men arguing with an older woman, and they said the water is theirs, it shouldn't be shared. And the older woman said something in passing at the end when she said, "Has anybody thought about what the river thinks?" And this led him to reflect on the fact that water and resources have become possessions. People actually think they have ownership over them and the right to decide what happens. And so they wrote this song called Pyasi from the point of view of the river. And it basically says, "I've become thirsty from giving you to drink.
So how popular is this song today, Chavi? I mean, do people kind of refer to the song?
Absolutely. It's not like in the top 10 charts, but right. On Twitter, on Facebook, it's being shared. People are remembering it. People understand that it's never going to be irrelevant. That's the sort of comments I've been seeing, that it's so sad that 7 years later, this song is totally topical.
All right. We're talking about the Silicon Valley of India. Just kind of orient us. When we get someone on the line from a call center in India, is this kind of the region where the calls are being picked up?
Almost always, yes.
So tell me what life is like there with all these techies and all these farmers who are suffering from drought.
Well, there's a water shortage. People have metered water in the day. They're having tankers deliver water. The reservoirs are doing better because there has been some rainfall. We've had a fairly good monsoon. But outside the cities, it was so torrential that the earth couldn't actually absorb it. So it ran off. There was a flooding situation with a landslide sort of thing where the topsoil was taken off. And this water just goes straight back into the ocean. So no, it doesn't help the farmers at all. And they're suffering. So we don't have a meteorological drought, but we do have an agricultural drought despite the normal monsoon.
Yeah, meantime, here in the U.S., a lot of states are dealing with their own droughts. Are there any lessons or shared knowledge from India aside from pray for rain, but not too much rain?
I have a feeling that we have a lot to learn as well, and we need to take drastic measures to actually harvest the rainwater and use our groundwater better. And maybe if the rest of the world is looking to us, they should learn from this, that there is such a thing as trying to avert disaster before it happens, because we're right smack in the middle of it.
Our friend, reporter Chavi Sachdev, speaking with us from Mumbai. Thank you very much, Chavi.
Thank you, Marco.
100 years ago today, the face of warfare was changed forever. It happened during World War I on a battlefield in northern France. That's when the British Army deployed the world's first tanks. These giant armored killing machines have been a central feature of combat ever since. It was a historic day, and who better to talk about it than the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe. So let me start with the obvious question, Chris. What happened that day? What was so different?
So just imagine you're a German soldier on that misty morning in France 100 years ago. You probably think you've seen every terror that modern war can show. Machine guns mowing down your comrades, barbed wire traps, artillery blasting away whole platoons, poison gas torturing your friends who are too slow to get their gas masks on. You're probably a pretty hardened soldier. And then out of the mist comes rumbling a giant armored machine, crushing all the barbed wire obstacles that you've put out there before, simply rolling over all the craters and ditches on its tracks. And then it starts spitting death from its machine guns and cannon. You shoot with every weapon you have, but it just simply can't be stopped. So what do? You can either stay and die, or you can panic and run. And so we're lucky enough to have found a recording of one survivor, a German lieutenant called Miles Reinke. Here he is speaking in a BBC program long after the war.
When I saw these tremendous machines, which we couldn't make out, we didn't know what they were, we never have seen them before, when they approached us, went downwards towards the trenches, we thought that we would be compelled to retreat towards Berlin.
And those Germans, what did they see that day, like the tank? Is it similar at all to what we have today, kind of a bulletproof bulldozer with a protective space inside for soldiers?
Yes, but visually it was very different to what you think of as a modern tank. It was more like a flat oblong that's been squashed down. Like I think the term is a rhomboid, with the cannon pod, the battle pods kind of on the side rather than on top.
What was it like on the side of the Brits driving these things?
Well, it was pretty daunting. There was huge pressure on them from the common foot soldiers who thought they were there to just end the war. So there was that kind of pressure. And then there was the task itself. So here's Lieutenant Victor Huffam, who was in charge of Tank D9 that day.
We had been taken down to the front line on the previous day and shown what we had to go through. It was terrifying. There were shell holes there that you could put houses in. The land was practically impassable. But we'd volunteered for the job. And we had a go.
Then there's an enlisted man we can hear from as well, a Private Roy Reifer. He was a gunner in one of the tanks. He also survived the war and described what it was like making that first tank attack 100 years ago today.
There was a terrific amount of noise in the tank, made up by the engine, the tracks. We were fired on by German machine guns, and the impact of their bullets was making the inside of the armor plate white hot.
So these flakes of hot white metal would come off from the sides of the tank and blind you, as happened to one of Roy's buddies on the other side of his tank, a guy called Billy Sugden.
So why was the tank developed?
If you've seen any movie about World War One, you have this vision of people in trenches with barbed wire in between them and nobody moving anywhere in this senseless kind of human wave attacks. So the idea was to have an armored machine that could break the stalemate and punch through those fortifications and allow one side to move on toward victory. So really the idea was that it was a machine that could break through the stalemate.
And why the word tank? Where'd that come from?
Well, that's particularly fascinating because the British developed the idea under a complete blanket of secrecy. So they created this whole scheme that they were going to call them mechanized water tanks for carrying water for the troops in Mesopotamia. Literally, they looked like water tanks, and that's what they told the workers they were building. So they just called them water tanks or tanks. And then one of the British officers involved thought that was a fun name, and they changed it. Previously, they were considering calling them land ships.
But as a means to end World War One, how effective was the tank?
It was really effective, but the momentum was kind of squandered because the Brits used them as soon as they had them ready, rather than some of the developers who wanted to mass them all together and achieve one big breakthrough. So those kind of attacks did happen right at the end of the war, but the opportunity was kind of wasted in 1916 because the Germans were able to develop tactics to counter it.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, always fascinating speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Thanks also to the BBC program Witness for making that archive tape available. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Today is the final day of the Hajj. That's the annual pilgrimage Muslims make to the Saudi city of Mecca. Millions of Muslims from all across the globe make the journey. And for those who go, it can be life-changing. Dia Hadid is in Mecca, writing about her experience for The New York Times. The Hajj, she says, has a central place in Islam, one of the five pillars of the faith, something Muslims must do in their lifetimes if they can. Hadid says once pilgrims arrive at Mecca, there are a series of rituals that must be followed.
They circle around a cube-like structure called the Kaaba, which Muslims call the House of God or the Ancient House, which they believe that Abraham built. Mm. They run or they walk between two peaks seven times that they believe Abraham's second wife Hagar ran between, looking for water for her son Ishmael, the biblical Ishmael. They go and they pray in an area called Arafat, and specifically, if they can, on a peak called the Mount of Mercy, where the Prophet Muhammad gave his last sermon to Muslims. They have to slaughter a sheep in honor of Abraham's sacrifice when God ordered him to slaughter his son. And they also, as possibly of all the weird things that I'm telling you, this one for me was probably the strangest. Muslims also stone three enormous pillars which symbolize the devil. And they symbolize the devil who tried to convince Abraham not to obey God's command.
That's a long list of things to do once you are there. Are there authorities who check in to make sure that you've done all these things, that you've actually completed the rituals that comprise the Hajj?
No. I mean, no one checks in on you. But in my experience, the overwhelming majority of Muslims who have the privilege of attending the Hajj are pretty dead set on doing it correctly because they really want God to accept their pilgrimage. Because for a Muslim to do a pilgrimage is to be born again.
How many times have you done the Hajj?
This is my first time.
And in your life, what's been your view of the Hajj? Have there been times when you felt you had to do it and other times you really wanted to do it? I suspect you wanted to be there this time.
I actually had a lot of mixed feelings about it. I mean, I was raised in a fairly devout, conservative Muslim family, but also a family that's like fiercely intellectual. And I'd always spoken with my family about the idea that I didn't necessarily think that any place was holier than any other place. But when this chance, it came to me, in the days leading up to the Hajj and the more I began to read about it, it really became a big deal for me.
What was it about the whole process that struck you as it's bigger than I thought it was?
I'm from like a big Arab, loud, talkative family, and we have this very lively WhatsApp group where we're just talking to each other all day. But then when it came time to tell them that I might be going the Hajj, they all took time to speak to me individually about their own experiences and the things that they had found meaningful.
And they had all done the pilgrimage previously?
All except for my older sister.
Okay.
And it was their words sort of like slowly sinking in. And that's sort of when the enormity of what might happen began to occur to me. And sometimes I would sit by myself and just sort of cry because I was so overwhelmed with what might happen.
You talked about just all the things you do once you are in Saudi Arabia, in Mecca. But even before getting there, there's a lot of preparation for the Hajj. Tell us about the kind of things you had to do before going to Mecca.
I would describe myself as a total like Hajj rookie because I definitely overpacked for a pilgrimage. There was a lot of running around. I don't wear the hijab, like a Muslim head covering in my day-to-day life. I don't have any long, loose robes. And so there was a lot of running around to get the right clothes for the Hajj. And, you know, my sister and my mother had been very specific, you know, get a long, loose abaya, which is a long, loose robe. Tailor it so it goes above your ankles, get one with a zip, no snap-on buttons, get zippers on your pockets or get inside pockets. They had these really specific descriptors for what I should be getting. And so I ended up running around East Jerusalem my final days, clearly looking like a crazy foreigner in these conservative Islamic shops saying, do you have a abaya that might be above my ankles with a zip and zippered pockets?
So that's the kind of practical stuff. But then you've got to pay off your debts. That's what the Quran dictates.
Because when you do the Hajj, it's really like closing a book of your life. You have to settle everything before you go. As I wrote in the New York Times story, because it was so painful for me, is that I had to finally pay a bill to a dentist who ruined my teeth. And
yeah, I wouldn't have done that.
I tried to get out of this. I remember when my father told me, I burst into tears. I'm not paying him. I'd rather don't go to Hajj. And my father was just like, listen, close the book of your life.
And you did.
And then it felt liberating. I wouldn't say it's the right thing to do day to day to pay a total con artist who destroys your teeth, but it felt good to have closed it. It felt good to walk away knowing that I had done everything possible to deal with anybody who might have something on me before I left.
You know, last year the Hajj was marred by tragedy. Hundreds of people died in the crush of a stampede and turned into a diplomatic incident because a disproportionate number of Iranians died. Has that been a shadow over the Hajj this year? And just personally, have you had some scary moments?
In fact, it was, I mean, the Associated Press, their tally was over 2,300 people who died. Mm. And it did cast a shadow over the security officials I met. They tried very hard to show us how prepared they were this year for the Hajj, and down to showing us the one-way routes through alleyways in the tent city of Mina, where pilgrims stay for 3 days and where the crush happened last year. But on the other hand, even though you could see it weighed heavily down on these security officials, and they would talk about it, they would talk about how awful they felt about what happened last year, officially the Saudi government has said nothing. And as myself and other journalists were telling Saudi officials at the Hajj, it's a disrespect to all those people who died. But was it scary this year in any way? There was a few moments where I felt like, wow, I'm really like, there's a lot of people and I'm worried that if one person trips over, we'll all be a human pileup. Mm-hmm. But in fact, there was a lot of security this year, and Saudi authorities tried very hard to make sure that no bottlenecks occurred. And that there was discipline in the sense of people walking and constantly moving in one direction so that a pileup wouldn't happen. Like, that was very palpable at the Hajj this year. Mm. They were very concerned that it would not happen again.
So, Dia, your first Hajj, and you got unexpectedly deep into the whole process as you got closer to the day for the pilgrimage. How has going to Mecca impacted how you feel about Islam and your own faith? Can you talk about that?
I mean, it still feels very hazy. I likened it to my mother as a mist that I'm waiting to settle. What has immediately struck me is after the Hajj, I want to be a better person. The Hajj really brings out the best in you and the worst in you because you're tried so much. It's hot, it's sweaty, it's rigorous, it's physically exhausting. And you're not allowed to argue with it at the Hajj. You're not allowed to lose your temper. And it teaches you a better way of being. And if there's one thing I'd like to take from the Hajj, it's that.
Dia Hadid reported her Hajj pilgrimage for the New York Times. Dia, thanks so much for telling us about your experience.
My pleasure. Thank you for calling.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Hope you'll be with us tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.